Particularly troubling is the effect the offense has had on Ms. Vance's family and the actions that had to be taken to protect her son from a predator, including at school. To state that this offense has had a significant impact on Ms. Vance and her family is an understatement. As someone with young children of his own, I hope that Ms. Vance's eloquent words have an impact on Mr. Oliver over his predatory actions. The judge then cited three passages from a 2016 Supreme Court of Canada decision saying that it was his responsibility to accept the joint agreement and sentence as already worked out between the Crown and the defense.
He was basically saying, my hands are tied here because of this and because of this and because of this. I sat there and my heart was beating.
As the sentencing was almost done, one of the lawyers present pointed out that something was missing. The agreement prohibited Oliver from going anywhere Jody might be, but it didn't say anything about stopping him from going places where her family could be found. This was important because, as you'll remember, Richard Oliver had directly threatened Jody's son. Attorney Lawrence Myers pointed this out to the court, and the sentencing was amended. But here's the thing. Myers was not the Crown prosecutor. He was in court defending the accused, his client, Richard Oliver.
You know, I don't even know how to put it into words, because I don't want to cast blame at what is clearly a junior Crown prosecutor taking on a case that I believe she did her best, but her best didn't serve what this case merited. So I don't want to cast blame on the Crown prosecutor. However, she didn't have that in there. Obviously, Lawrence Myers, the defense attorney, is a veteran and savvy at this and knows his client. So I look at that as, you know, there is serious decency within this process when somebody goes, hey, by the way, why don't we just like make sure her family's in there too, as the person who's defending someone.
When all was said and done, Richard Oliver would not go to jail for what he had put Jody Vance and her family through.
It's taken me 7 years to meet face-to-face in a court of law and have my say with my victim impact statement. It was a long, long road to there, and it was incredibly disappointing to see the failure of our justice system. And I don't blame Christina Gallo, and I don't blame, you know, Judge LaPrairie. I don't even blame the defense attorney doing his job. He certainly ran circles around the Crown prosecutor in getting this joint agreement put through. Because the consequences are basically a slap on the wrist, if that. But I still had to see it through. I had my day in court.
Jody isn't done. She and Jesse Miller will be suing Oliver in a civil suit.
And the lawyer who was recommended to me immediately responded and said, absolutely, this is a case that we would look to take on. And it would be a precedent-setting case in British Columbia because it would be the first ever online criminal harassment civil suit to be brought. I think that's very important.
That precedent could have a ripple effect in Canada. Online abuse, harassment, and threats have been a growing problem for years, disproportionately affecting women, especially racialized women, and especially racialized women working in the media.
It makes me emotional to think of, because I think of the Erica Eiffels or the Rachel Gilmores, the young Black, Indigenous, people of color, the women who are getting so much hate right now and how much their lives are being impacted by that, and nobody's really doing anything to protect them urgently. It shouldn't take 7 years to make somebody stop harassing you.
Last summer, a number of journalists were targeted in a hate-filled campaign of abuse. Among them were Rachel Gilmore, formerly of Global News, Saba Aitazaz, co-host and producer for the Toronto Star's Daily News podcast This Matters, as well as Erica Eiffel, a columnist at The Hill Times. We spoke with Erica about her experiences.
It really began last summer, and it started off with an email on Canada Day. And I thought it was at least innocuous enough to like ignore. Saba got the same email and somebody else got the same email on the same day. Fast forward about a month later, 6 weeks later, we got a bunch of targeted emails with like rape threats and death threats and misogyny and deep, deep anti-Blackness and racism, you know, telling us that basically we have a target on our backs, and, you know, they were pretty sinister.
And Erica feels that going to the cops about this harassment isn't useful.
It's a waste of time and emotional energy. There's a whole group of women who are affected by this. What's clear is that police don't know how to deal with it. And they're not interconnected enough on this issue to actually do anything. The structure is such that you go into local law enforcement, you report, and it stays at local law enforcement. There's like no attempt to, I don't know, forward it on or to maybe like an online hate crimes unit or something where they can map out the structure of these organizations, who they talk to, who they're involved with, who funds them, that kind of thing. Like, that's what we should be doing. So law enforcement only started taking this seriously once we made noise online. For the first time ever, by the way, newsroom got together and signed an open letter calling on the minister and law enforcement and so forth to do something.
Both Rachel and Saba tweeted about long wait times on the phone to file police reports and what seemed to be a general disinterest from the person on the phone in what they were reporting. I asked Jody what she thought could be done to improve her experience with the justice system.
I think with the abundance of evidence, similar to what happened with me, it would be very simple to have swift and meaningful consequences. Do it again, it's $1,000. Do it again after that, it's $10,000. Do it again after that, it's $100,000. There are your deterrents. There's no jail involved. There's no trial involved. It's like a parking ticket or a speeding ticket. You do that, you get punished. Swift and meaningful consequences. With harassment, it's pretty clear. But law enforcement should have the ability to say, you know what? I know who that is. Their IP address tells us they're this. We can contact that person and tell them to cease and desist. And if they don't have $1,000, $10,000, or $100, you know what? You don't get to get a driver's license. There's a way to make it a deterrent as opposed to an ongoing, ever-growing legal bog down of our justice system. And I do want to add one more thing. Canceling people isn't the goal here. Counseling people should be the goal. People who come after others in a harassing way need help. It's not normal. It is also not normal to be harassed. And people who are suffering harassment thinking they just need to tough it out because it's now normal need to go back to it's not normal. This needs to be fixed and it needs results in expedited fashion because this is a massive problem and it is affecting the mental health and well-being of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people across this country.
That's your Canada Land episode. You can email me about this show at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything that you send. This episode was reported by our audio editor and technical producer, Tristan Capicchione. Editorial assistance by Jonathan Goldsby. Our managing editor is Annette Ejofor. I'm your host, Jesse Brown, and our theme music is by So Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Follow them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. Joanna Chu, senior reporter of the Toronto Star, author, joining us today from Vancouver.
Hey, Jesse. I just saw you in Toronto last month.
It's nice to be talking to you again. Today on the show, Joanna, the national crime spree that we can't legally talk too much about, youth crime and reporting bans. Welcome to Shortcuts, where we talk shit about the news. Joanna, terrible story here in Toronto. Last weekend, 16-year-old Gabriel Migueles was coming back from the mall, from the Eaton Centre in downtown Toronto, with a friend, and he was randomly stabbed 3 times in the chest in an unprovoked attack, and he later died. And this story, as awful as it is sadly not an uncommon story. There have been a string of assaults, stabbings, swarmings, murders on TTC property, transit property, over the past year. The Star counted them up in January, and there were over 20 of them at that point over the previous 12 months. What is uncommon about this particular instance is that because the teenager involved in this crime was the victim and not the accused perpetrator, we actually have some information about the crime and about the accused perpetrator. And we know that it's a 22-year-old, Jordan O'Brien Tobin, of no fixed address, appears to have a history of criminal charges and open arrest warrant out for him. People can read the story if they want to read more about him. But that's uncommon because there have been so many of these stories, and not just in Toronto. Youth crime stories, often the word swarming comes up, often stabbing comes up, often transit comes up, and we just are getting so little information. Teen charged with attempted murder after a stabbing at Nova Scotia school. This terrible swarming where 8 girls, some just 13 years old, have been charged in a fatal swarming attack on, seems to be a stranger. And one of your colleagues at the Star trying to cover that, but can't really tell us anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
Stories out of Winnipeg. I could go on and on with the headlines, you know, as a parent, as a citizen, and just like trying to figure out, like, what do I need to be aware of? I can't even begin to guess at what these crimes are like or what they look like or what's going on, because we have very strict rules when it comes to youth offenders in the press.
Yeah, actually, my colleague, Jennifer Pagliaro, she spent 2 months in youth court going in and out of court and basically got nothing. So she wrote a piece about why she's dedicated that time, even though it was illegal to report on a lot of what's happening. But I think how some media are getting together to try to demand at least some context, some basics of the cases, because basically the way Canada's rules are, it's pretty much nothing.
You know, this 16-year-old earlier this month killed 2 cops in Edmonton. Mm-hmm. And shot his mother and then himself. And we got like emails from listeners being like, hey, how come they're naming this kid? How come I'm finally able to learn about him and hear about his mental health troubles and actually get some insight into the systems that may have failed here? You know, there's a picture of the kid. I'm actually learning a little bit about this. I thought that the press wasn't allowed. And for a second, I was like, yeah, that is weird. And then, you know, my colleague Jonathan Goldsby goes, oh, that's because he's dead. If the kid dies, then we don't protect their privacy. I understand why we don't want to be running the names of youth offenders. First of all, we don't know that they did it yet. They haven't been proven guilty. Mm-hmm. And second, even if they did, there is a lot of emphasis placed on the possibility for rehabilitation, and you don't want that, you know, haunting their Google results and everything else for the rest of their lives. But when you're talking about what looks increasingly like a national crisis, I mean, we talk about the public interest. Like, so why does the newsreader have a right to know about this? Well, I can't think of a more urgent public interest case than just like, I don't want this to happen to my kids. If there's some common thread in some of these cases where, like, I hate to sound like such an old fogey here, but like, are these kids listening to the same music? Is there some weird, like, thrill kill thing happening here? Are these completely disconnected, isolated cases? What we get from the media instead are these sort of like, let's look at the systemic structures. Let's look at how the schools are failing and mental health. And that's all very important stuff to look at here.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just sort of hard to make much of that systemic analysis when I don't even know how these crimes are occurring and what they look like or how you can look out for them.
You know, it's really, like, I was crying yesterday. Like, your producer sent me a list of these stories, and I've been trying to, like, control my consumption of, like, really distressing media and seeing that all. Like, you do see, it does seem like a pattern. It does seem like a spike. And that kind of speculation about, like, why, I think it does sort of help, because a lot of people are saying perhaps the terrible economy, a lot of kids, their families facing homelessness, losing their homes because of the crazy rising prices and years of isolation, social isolation, like the lack of proper education because of school lockdowns.
Yeah, the pandemic is, you know, that's, I think, the most, you know, I hate to, like, be reductive, but obviously it seems that that's just like a clear aspect of this.
Yeah. And so I don't think necessarily, like, trying to get, you know, people who study these things to weigh in is useless. And just even to expand it beyond kids, like, I was just shocked, like, reading about what happened in Vancouver recently when a dad, you know, had some sort of confrontation with someone who seemed pretty mentally unstable, ended up getting killed in front of his wife and kids, just randomly outside a Vancouver cafe.
Yeah.
It's just, you see all of these things happening, like, you don't even want to go outside your house. Like, when I was in Toronto, like, and in the wake of all the TTC stabbings, I'm like, I'm going to walk. I'm not going to jump on that train. I know, it's hard, and it makes you feel really powerless when there are these really huge cases and reporters can't report anything, even though, like, you list the reasons why. It is very disconcerting, I think, for a lot of people. Do you have any suggestions on what could possibly change? Like,
I don't know. It's another one where I feel like my inclination, my bias is always towards knowing more. And I am heartened when I hear that, like, reporters are fighting for the right to get some more information on the record, even though I'm sympathetic to the reasons why those laws exist. The best thing I read about this was somebody put forth the idea that, like, you know what would really help in a situation like this? If we had cell phones that worked when we were on the subway in Toronto.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, like I'm just looking for something tangible here because, mm-hmm. again, it's the vacuum of information that makes you feel really powerless, and that's where fear grows.
Yeah.
It's all well and good and really, I think, necessary to hear about the systemic issues, but the systemic issues feel like very, like how's that going to help us not have four more of these in the next month?
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to solve the systemic issues in the next month, but, like, maybe telecom infrastructure is even harder, but at least that mm-hmm. feels, like, tangible, like,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and also school safety. I read that a lot of schools, like, entranceways are not very secure and they don't have video cameras that are working, and it's slow to request updates for just, like, basic security at schools.
Yeah.
And that's not going to be comforting to parents either. You hear about shootings in outside Canadian schools. We're not exempt from mass shootings that we see, sadly, in the States all the time.
I don't know. It's pretty scary stuff.
Just the gravity of that a lot of people, their mental health might be broken, or their families might just be broken, you know, post-COVID impacts or recession impacts. Like, it's a huge story that is hard to wrap your head around.
Joanna, we duly note stories on this show when there's a new story that we're afraid people might otherwise miss. Do you have something to duly note for our listeners today?
Yeah, so in the spirit of authoritarian strongman politics in Turkey, Erdogan, you know, facing elections May 14th, and it's the first time since he was in power in 2003 where he could lose his seat. And he's been kind of like a strongman leader of Turkey since then, and taking a turn towards being more authoritarian, kind of more, instead of being more secular, going to more persecution of religious minorities. So it'd be interesting if this kind of strongman does end up losing power, because Turkey still and does have some democratic elections. So that would kind of change the shape of kind of allies of China, of, you know, this kind of dynamic of people who are more authoritarian. But Turkey's very complicated, and I also have heard that some of the opposition, they've also been kind of going more to the far right to try to steal votes from Erdogan supporters. So we'll see if him losing or potentially losing might mean that Turkey will be less authoritarian. So
duly noted. I want to quickly duly note some headlines related to a story that we've been bringing you over the course of, I don't know, like a year or so now, maybe more. Our colleague Sarah Larniuk has been telling our listeners a story of this mysterious neurological syndrome afflicting people, many of whom in New Brunswick, and questions about the government's story and even some lies that she was able to catch the government of New Brunswick in, and failing to actually track down the source of this. The people who are suffering from this got together this week with the Green Party in New Brunswick, with Green Party leader David Kuhn, to demand that the hunt for answers go on. And confirming some things that Canada Land listeners heard earlier, it's not like 45 or 47 patients who are suffering from this bizarre, debilitating neurological symptoms, but the number is like 147. And the word that I took special note of in the CBC's coverage of this press conference that they held, and the Globe and Mail's coverage, the word to watch going forward is glyphosate. And that is a weed killer, a very controversial herbicide that has been sprayed all across New Brunswick. And two of the different people suffering say that they've tested, or their relatives have tested, incredibly high. One tested 47 times what is an acceptable level of glyphosate. And this story isn't going anywhere. And I think that's where people should keep track of as the story progresses.
Duly noted.
Well, that's Shortcuts.
On that note.
Joanna, thank you for joining me. We are on Twitter at Canada Land. I can be emailed at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything that people send. Joanna Chu, where can people find you?
I'm on Twitter with my name, Joanna Chu. Message me. I spend too much time on there. You know, my book, China Unbound, is available in libraries, or there's a pretty extensive free preview on Google Books. So it would make me feel a lot better with all of the stuff going on if more people read the context, the global context I tried to bring together.
This episode is produced by Aviva Lessard with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our managing editor is Annette Ejofo. Theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV, 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.